every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat, or BAT 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Path towards enlightenment.
In the name of God, the All Compassionate, the All Merciful. Salam and welcome to another episode of our weekly series titled Path Towards Enlightenment, which is an endeavor to make you and us familiar with an easy and fluent explanation of God's final scripture to all mankind, the Noble Quran, which was revealed to the last and greatest of all messengers, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. We continue from where we left you last week, and here is Ayah 36 of Surah Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny.
إنما الحياة الدنيا لعب ولهو وإن تؤمنوا وتتقوا يؤتكم أجوركم ولا يسألكم أموالكم.
The life of this world is just play and diversion. But if you are faithful and God-weary, He will give you your rewards and will not ask your wealth in return from you. If you remember, in our explanation of the preceding ayah of this surah last Friday, we said the true believers should never be apprehensive of their small number or shortage of facilities vis-a-vis the enemy. For God is with the faithful, and He will ultimately grant them victory. In other words, faith is not compatible with slackening, laziness, and comfort-seeking, which means the faithful should never seek compromise with the enemy, either on the battlefield or at the negotiating table, since this is a sign of weakness and fear. But if the enemy proposes peace on fair conditions, they may accept it after due evaluation, rather than giving all concessions and receiving none, which means bowing to blackmail. The ayah that we recited to you is continuation of the warning against frailty and complacency against disbelievers, and refers to the main cause of frailty, that is, attachment to worldly possessions. Many people regard the world as the scene of pastime and pleasure, while the true believers consider it as the scene of divine manifestations and a blessing to gain the rewards of afterlife. It could be said that this ayah encourages Muslims to obey God, fulfill their duties, and do not shun the issue of jihad. It also refers to the vanity of mundane life, since worldly attachments serve as a factor hindering people from engagement in jihad. Among the factors for attachment to the world are quests for wealth and power, and those who acquire wealth rarely spend it in the way of God. Their likeness is that of travelers who forget the destination by being fascinated by the roadside scenarios. In contrast, the true believers do appreciate the beautiful scenes during the journey, abstain from ugly sights, and tolerate the hardships, but never think of the world as the permanent abode, because the destination is much more enchanting. Naturally, they neither covet wealth nor crave power, because they know that everything is from God, and that greed and stinginess impede the swift movement on the road of life. Thus, whatever they have acquired, they spent from it generously in the way of God on orphans, the needy, and the like, as well as for jihad, since it is important to defend the country, safeguard independence, maintain peace and security, and develop the infrastructure. From this ayah, we learn that, number one, excessive attachment to the world and its pleasures result in forgetting the hereafter, while true believers are never distracted by material life. Number two, though money and property are among the requirements of life, we should enjoy them according to our modest needs instead of amassing them. And number three, God has promised rewards for good deeds without taking anything in return. Now let us listen to ayah 37 of the same surah.
إِن يَسْأَلْكُمُوهَا فَيُحْفِكُمْ تَبْخَلُوا وَيُخْرِجْ أَضْغَانَكُمْ.
Should he ask it from you and press you, you will be stingy and he will expose your spite. This ayah indicates the attachment of some persons to worldly possessions to the extent that even if God asks them for anything, they will harbor ill will because of their stinginess and spite. In fact, this ayah serves as a reproach to those entrapped in such attachments, while for the God-weary, it is a source of encouragement for detachment from the pull of material life. Thus, God Almighty, through such reproach, awakens the dormant souls in order to free them from the shackles of mundane possessions through sacrifices in the divine path, while beseeching him to bestow faith, piety, and satisfaction. This ayah teaches us the following points. Number one, everything including wealth, power, and life is from God and should be spent in his way without any stinginess. Number two, God hasn't levied any huge taxes, and whatever the noble Quran says about the zakat and khums to be paid by the rich is only a meager percentage of what he has granted them of wealth to test their faith. And number three, refusal and stinginess in this regard only expose such persons as a stingy, spiteful, and thankless. Thank you. let us listen to Ayah 38, the last one of Surah Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny.
سبيل الله فمنكم من يبخل ومن يبخل فإنما يبخل عن نفسه والله الغني وأنتم الفقراء وإن تتولوا يستبدل قوما غيركم ثم لا يكونوا أمثالكم.
Ah, there you are, being invited to spend in the way of Allah. Yet among you, there are those who are stingy. Whoever is stingy only to his or herself. Allah is the all-sufficient, and you are all needy. And if you turn away, He will replace you with another people, and they will not be like you. This ayah calls on Muslims to spend in the way of Allah by helping others, but they should be free to think and make their choice. Those who are stingy should not think that God is in need of them and their possessions, since it is we who are in need of God, the All-Sufficient, because without His mercy and the relief He has accorded us, we would have perished. In other words, the rich but stingy persons who do not pay the meager amounts of zakat and homes, as well as those who do not contribute to jihad, which guarantees the country's independence and dignity, or those fleeing from it on fear of losing lives, deprive themselves of the bounties of God and His rewards in the hereafter. The last phrase of the ayah is a warning to the Arab Muslims to appreciate the great divine favor of raising the last and greatest prophet amongst them. But if they continue their disobedience and thanklessness, God Almighty will raise another people far superior to them, in terms of sacrificing their life and possessions in the cause of Allah. According to exegetes of the Noble Quran, both Sunni and Shia Muslims, when the companions of the Prophet asked, "Who are the people mentioned in this ayah?" he put his hand on the shoulder of his Iranian companion, Salman Farsi, and said, "This man and his people. By the one in whose hand is my life, if faith is placed in their plates, they will acquire it." The Prophet's sixth infallible heir, Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace upon him, is reported to have said in this regard, "By God, he has kept his promise, and a far better non-Arab people have replaced them." Taking a glance without any prejudice at the history of Islam and Islamic sciences, we discover that many non-Arab Muslims, particularly the Iranians, have greatly contributed to jihad against the enemies of faith and humanity, while their achievements in the field of Islamic sciences are evident to all. This ayah teaches us the following points. Number one, stinginess is not in compliance with faith, and everyone should spend in the way of God according to their financial ability, with full knowledge that the Almighty Creator is all-sufficient. Number two, those who fulfill their duties are assured of divine rewards, both in this world and the hereafter. And number three, the independence of the country, the dignity of its people, and the peace and development of the society are ensured through proper spending of wealth and sacrifices offered by the nation. Dear listeners, we have reached the end of Surah Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Inshallah, next week we will start explanation of the next surah, that is Fatih. God bless you and goodbye.
It's Parliament that makes the headlines with legislation. But no bill passed by Parliament or Majlis becomes law without going through the Guardian or Constitutional Council. Less in the spotlight normally, there are times when this Council of Elders becomes the highlight of the day. One of those times is elections, be they parliamentary, presidential, or assembly of experts elections. What exactly the function of the Guardians of the Constitution is when it comes to elections is the focus of our study in this episode. The 12-member Guardian Council of Legal Experts supervises elections and approves or disqualifies candidates. It also has veto power over legislation. It's something of an upper house, so omitting it from Iran's legal system would be unthinkable. However, it does come under scrutiny and criticism from time to time, especially with the 2021 elections. I'm Leila Faramayazi. The council chaired by Ayatollah Jannati approved only 7 candidates to run for president in the June 18th election. That was out of a total of 592 prospective candidates, 552 men and 40 women. The list of candidates or finalists was communicated on May the 25th and has since kept eyebrows raised with foreign critics who incessantly bring the Conservative Council under attack. Mr. Atrianfar is among those at home expressing displeasure at the Guardian jurist selection. He is a reformist and member of the executives of Construction Party, who met with us at Press TV studios.
هیچگاه نباید نهادهای حقوقی به خصوص شورای نگهبان جدگیری سیاسی داشته.
Legal institutions, especially the Constitutional Council, must never be politically biased. The council was expected to adhere to this standard for the upcoming election. When a large number of people, at least 40 prominent figures among them, had registered to run for president, the political bias resulted in the elimination of almost every candidate who had political links with the reformists or was favored by like-minded institutions and were barred from the race. The situation at this point is so that out of 7 esteemed presidential candidates, 5 definitely belong to the principalists, and the 2 others don't represent the reformists.
Well now, the more conservative or principalist walk of Iran's political spectrum wouldn't want to leave that unanswered. I got to talk to a couple of parliamentarians to hear them on whether the Guardians might have made a political decision, when in fact they are to vet candidates based on their legal credentials and existing documents. Mr. Nowruzi is vice chief of the Parliamentary Legal Committee.
Anyway, if the reformists hadn't introduced weak or problematic figures, they would definitely have the chance to see their candidates approved. I'm not a member of the Constitutional Council, but my question is, why didn't the reformists introduce Mr. Arif? Why didn't they put forth figures who could be qualified to run? Anyhow, they endorse people like Mr. Jahangiri, who have their own problems. Mr. Jahangiri has to be accountable for the economic problems in the past 8 years, because he has been the first vice president, a position comparable to the country's prime minister. He can't come forward and complain. He must first explain what he's been doing in the past 8 years and then run for president.
Besides Mr. Raisi, the judiciary chief, other principalists approved to run are Saeed Jalili, former Supreme National Security Council secretary and nuclear negotiator, Mohsen Rezai, expediency council secretary, as well as MPs Ali Reza Zakani and Amir Hossein Ghazizadeh Hashemi. Non-principalists are Abdel Nasser Hemmati, Central Bank of Iran former governor, who's a moderate, and Mohsen Mehralizadeh, reformist, former vice president. Registration and vetting and campaigning make for an intricate electoral procedure, intricate like Iran's political system of several member bodies, each presiding over the other. Everything is detailed and foreseen in the hope of leaving no room for error, But then, with too many hands at work, it can, like bureaucracy, trip itself up. And there's human error that can presumably occur with these supreme deciding bodies. Sometimes, as in the case of Larijani, despite the fact that he is a veteran, the Supreme National Security Council's decision to ban first-degree relatives of candidates from studying abroad leads to disqualification.
We don't have anything called disqualification in the presidential election. In fact, we assess the qualification of those who run. This doesn't mean that those who aren't approved are unfit or incompetent for other tasks or positions. What Article 155 stipulates is that the qualified president must meet a set of conditions, including being a political or religious figure, being a resourceful manager, being a citizen of Iran and of Iranian origin. Members of the Constitutional Council consider these conditions for every candidate and finally announce whether or not the individuals are eligible to run for president after a secret ballot.
Mr. Zakir is chief of the Parliamentary Article 90 Committee.
Mr. Larijani has been more of a principalist than a reformist. If he's rejected, it wasn't because he was a reformist. If candidates request explanations about why they have been disqualified, the Constitutional Council can tell them. The candidate can also make it public. There's no legal prohibition against it. But there is usually a convincing reason and expert work behind the decision.
Sometimes the case of Mr. Mehr Alizadeh can find itself repeated. He was disqualified in one election due to the fact that a case was pending against him, but in the next round he was approved due to acquittal.
According to Article 115 of the Constitution, the president must meet certain conditions. One is that he must be of Iranian origin. The other is that he must be a political or a religious figure and be a resourceful manager. None of these conditions are biased for or against any group, camp, or political organization. The conditions consider the candidate's talents, policymaking, and management capabilities in running the country and solving its problems.
It's an executive hand that's in charge of jump-starting and finalizing the election process in practice. That's the Interior Ministry. Pursuant to Article 48 of the election law, executive boards send the names of candidates to four authorities for screening. Those are the judiciary, the Ministry of Intelligence, the police, and the Civil Registration Organization. Now, how Guardian Council members themselves are appointed and what the composition of the body looks like, you may care to know. Of the 12 jurists, six of them are experts in Islamic law and they are appointed by the leader, who is himself elected by the Assembly of Experts. The other six civil jurists are nominated by the Supreme Judicial Council and appointed by Parliament or Majlis. The council also has six lawyers recommended to Parliament by the head of the judiciary to be confirmed and included in the council.
Following the Islamic Revolution of 1979, although the Constitution has it that the members of the Guardian Council must be changed every 6 years, 3 years after the establishment of the Guardian Council, six members from amongst both batches of the jurists, Islamic and civil, were changed. This policy was adopted in order to prevent any temporary closure of the Guardian Council. This way, the council will always have six definite members. As a result, the system is so that six members of the 12 members of the Guardian Council undergo a reshuffle every 3 years.
Regarding the council's participation in national events, our MPs speak of how it safeguards the Islamic revolution through these, say through elections.
According to the Constitution, the president is the country's second most important figure after the leader. He's the one who has to execute cultural, social, political, commercial, monetary, financial, banking, petrochemical, and other laws. Any candidate who wins the election must be able to bring everyone together from across the country. If this happens, the revolution thrives and the country will be united. If the elected president is chosen based on meritocracy, the country will be united free of conflict and revolutionary. The Constitutional Council is responsible to ensure that. The Council has thought for some 800 hours to select which candidate can run the country for the next 4 or 8 years.
I said the Guardian Council is inseparable from the country's system of legal and political governance as it stands. Interestingly, even its critics, at least domestic political ones, don't criticize it as a body.
We shouldn't criticize the Constitutional Council itself, as the leader of the Islamic Revolution has also stressed. We should protect the prestige and identity of the legal institutions as enshrined in the Constitution. But we can criticize the performance of the Council's members. During the leadership of late Imam Khomeini, if the members of the Constitutional Council made any mistakes, he would criticize them and advise them to correct their behavior. We should question those who didn't vote for Mr. Larijani and ask them to explain what their argument has been.
Now, whatever strategy or insight might leave the last man standing, it's all for elections to be held for the people to choose a new president. Incumbent President Rouhani's second term is coming to a close, with very little time left for the Vienna JCPOA talks to conclude in sanctions relief for Iran. Any success the outgoing government has with the talks would be cause for greater voter turnout mid-June. I'm only half done, but it's time to give other media outlets time for their say as well. So for a quick media review, stay tuned. And here's words they put it in. Fars News reads, leader asks Iranian people to stage large turnout in elections. During a meeting via video link with members of the Iranian parliament on Thursday, May the 27th, Ayatollah Khamenei first thanked all individuals who were nominated to run in elections. Many of these people undoubtedly entered the scene because they felt a responsibility to, he said. Secondly, Ayatollah Khamenei said, I have to doubly thank those whose qualification was not approved and was not ascertained by the council and who reacted nobly. Some of them even encouraged people to participate in the election. The leader said the fact that the Constitutional Council had not been able to ascertain the qualification of certain candidates did not mean that those individuals were not qualified. They may even be highly qualified. What it meant was that the council had not been able to determine such a qualification based on its own recognition, the reports, and the available tools. Dear Iranian nation, election takes place in one day, but its outcome is there for several years. Participate in the election. Consider the election as belonging to yourselves, because it does belong to you, Ayatollah Khamenei said. Tehran Times quotes the council's spokesperson, Kat Khodayi, projects high voter turnout. In an interview with Press TV on Tuesday, Abbas Ali Kat Khodayi said, when it comes to verification and vetting, the impact of the Constitutional Council's votes on the people's participation is very little. That, he said, is what opinion polls conducted by state institutions show. It's usually most likely about economic issues and maybe some political and social issues. He said the council carries out its responsibilities based on the constitution as the fundamental law of the country and is duty bound to do the vetting process. If a person is vetted and not approved, we are not to blame. We have to act on the basis of law. We have Abna referring to a Sunni cleric saying vigilant nation attends election to decide for its fate. A Sunni Friday prayer leader in southeastern Iran believes that the Iranian nation are vigilant and will participate in the upcoming presidential election across Iran to decide their own fate. Molavi Abdurrahim Rigyanpur, Sunni Friday prayer leader of Mejave, a city in southeastern Iranian province of Sistan-Balochistan, made remarks in an interview with IRNA. Participation in the elections is a religious duty, and respect for objectives of Imam Khomeini, the father of the Islamic Revolution, the Sunni cleric said. During the past years, enemies, arrogant powers, and global Zionism have in vain been trying to downgrade the people's participation in Iran's elections, he added. Despite the sanctions, Iran will powerfully stand on its own feet, the Sunni cleric stressed. That would be it for this segment. Do stay tuned. Foreign policy will no doubt pose pretty potent challenges for any new president and his cabinet. Let's hear what they will face from our show guests.
The president must run the country. It is not possible to run a country without interacting with the world. We have had relationships with all the world when both principalists and reformists were incumbent, with a few exceptions like the occupying Israeli regime. As a matter of fact, if principalists win the upcoming election, they would have greater interactions with the world. We want to maintain our country's authority.
Now, the main challenge any new president would face in this country has got to be economic. That is why the JCPOA talks matter. To Iran, the whole point of the talks is that US and E3 economic sanctions be lifted off this country. Only then will a US return to the JCPOA or Iran nuclear deal even matter to us.
You see, our economic structure is really in shambles. Our currency and tax system are in disarray. There are so many unemployed youths. 12 million young people aren't getting married because they don't have a home. While the Minister of Roads and Urban Development says he doesn't believe in cheap housing options just for the sake of being stubborn and based on his personal beliefs, it's evident that the country won't thrive. I think the Constitutional Council can intervene here and choose capable candidates fairly, regardless of their political orientation. They should approve people who won't make the society bipolar or tripolar or sow discord and only consider themselves.
Interestingly, not all Iranian authorities see sanctions as wholly bad. In fact, the absolute majority see a use in sanctions alongside the vice. That is getting closer to independence, because with deprivation comes resistance economy. That's moving to mobilize the country's industry, hence independence. That is not to say sanctions are not a nuisance, of course, even to domestic manufacture. Developing domestic manufacture can be achieved with technology transfers and investments made possible by the lifting of sanctions. This in turn would enable greater growth and lucrative exports for Iranian industries. And fortunately, in the absence of Western alliance, Iran still has some useful friends elsewhere.
He won't be just the president, but someone whose performance shapes the country's political future for at least the next 10 to 20 years. Our citizens' psychological comfort and economic security are affected and take shape by the president's policies on economic issues as the country's senior executive manager. This is unanimously agreed upon. Society expects the same, so do our political elites, the incumbent government, and most importantly, the leader of the Islamic Revolution.
We popped out and learned what people think of shortcomings and what they expect of their next president.
One of the most serious problems is that people's purchasing power is very weak. There is tremendous economic pressure on them.
I expect the new president to care more about the youth. All the young people are unemployed. Some of them want to leave the country. They don't want to stay in Iran. The most urgent priority is employment.
Anyone who wants to be president in the new term, as the leader said, must be the most efficient politician and fully familiar with the flaws in the system.
One priority is the creation of jobs for young people, which has been very weak. The other is the astronomical prices. Another is enabling young people to get married. One of the main weaknesses of our current president is that he has not fulfilled any of his promises so far.
The least the next president is expected to do is to care for those who live in a poor economic situation.
People's most important demand is that the president be able to address their problems and create jobs.
Like many things related to Iran, its Guardian Council comes under international criticism in great part due to the country's system of governance being anew. It's a democracy with a name, an Islamic democracy. The Guardian or Constitutional Council as a legal body is not dissimilar to any other in the world. In France, the Constitutional Council is the highest constitutional authority.
The principle of supervision is observed by all countries, whether those in Europe, the US or elsewhere. But the methods differ according to the nature of the countries. Considering that our constitution has a religious basis, part of the responsibility of the Constitutional Council is to ensure that the resolutions don't violate religious laws. The Council's members generally are tasked with ensuring that the passed laws are based on the Constitution.
Its duties are first the supervision of elections and ensuring the legitimacy of referendums. That's going by Articles 58, 59, and 60. And second, the interpretation of the fundamental meanings of the Constitution, legislation, and treaties.
It is a Zionist thought to polarize the elections. The instance is Trumpism or Bidenism. They polarize the society, and instead of proposing their plans, they locked their horns and got involved in their private affairs, shouted and insulted each other. The result was that Congress came under a deadly attack. Our elections don't polarize the people. The election is multipolar. Different personalities are nominated and qualified, will later compete in a healthy environment, and are chosen by the people, according to their plans, discussed during ethical debates.
To get back to Iran's Guardian Council and elections, the Council's 25th May approval of finalists meant those candidates could start campaigning until June the 16th, 2 days before the election. That would allow for a one-day period when campaigning is banned. Candidates will have three televised debates, which could swing the vote against all expectation, as they have done so with the past three presidents. The Interior Ministry has said it could extend voting until 2 a.m. on June the 19th, since the polls will not operate at full capacity in order to observe COVID-19 guidelines.
The reformists are now considering the options in a situation where their prominent nominees, including Mr. Asaf Jahangiri, Mr. Pezeshkian, Mr. Mohsen Hashemi, Mr. Shariat, and others are rejected. They are probably planning to endorse the two reformist leading candidates for now and decide on who would withdraw from the race in favor of the other on the eve of the election day based on their popularity in opinion polls.
That's it for today. Thanks from the whole team. But do tune in again at the same times next week and each week after, as there's plenty more to be said on the elections in weekly shows and even our 10-minute specials in the run-up to the election, 18th June. Bye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
limelight.
A digital yuan might rewrite the rules of international banking, says David Goldman, editor, in an article published under the heading, Digital Yuan Could Bust the United States. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Historians still quibble about what event marked the end of the Roman Empire. Some future historians might choose January 16, 2021 as the fatal moment for the American Empire. That's when the People's Bank of China and SWIFT, the global system for international monetary transfers, set up a joint venture to promote the use of China's digital currency in cross-border payments. It's early days, but the joint venture could denote the end of the dollar's role as the dominant medium of international exchange and, more importantly, the end of more than $20 trillion of cheap loans to the United States from the rest of the world. The U.S. is able to run budget deficits now approaching a fifth of its gross domestic product, GDP, a level usually associated with third world countries on the brink of hyperinflation because the rest of the world holds foreign exchange reserves and transactions balances equal to a full year of America's GDP. China already is the world's biggest exporter and will become the world's largest economy in dollar terms before the end of this decade. When, and the issue is when rather than if, China's currency assumes a world status, consumerate with its economic standing, the dollar's reserve role will fade like the pound sterling before it, and the United States will have to learn to spend within its means. That implies a wrenching adjustment for a U.S. economy dependent on vast amounts of foreign credit. Economists call this sage murriage after the premium that a monarch earned by coining precious metal into currency. The value of sage murriage has exploded during the past decade. Now it may implode. Blandly titled the Financial Gateway Information Service, the new company is the first official alliance of the Society for Worldwide International Financial Telecommunication and China's Central Bank. China's RMB accounts for just 2% of transactions in the SWIFT system today, and China's financial system is far from ready to take on a reserve role. All of that could change, and swiftly, to coin a phrase. For the time being, the goals of the new financial gateway are modest. It has just 10 million euros in capital, 55% contributed by SWIFT and 34% by the China National Clearing Center, that is CNCC, an entity created by the People's Bank of China as an alternative to SWIFT after the Trump administration reportedly considered shutting Chinese institutions out of the SWIFT system. Cross-border interbank payments and settlements LTD, the CNCC's foreign exchange arm, owns 5%, and the People's Bank of China's Digital Currency Research Institute owns 3%. Digital currencies promise to drastically reduce transaction costs for international trade financing while improving transaction security. In the 18th century, financier Nathan Rothschild said, a bill of exchange in international trade should taste of salt after accompanying cargo on a sea voyage. Blockchain allows the tracking of goods from factory to warehouse to port to container ship, and enables just-in-time deliveries along with just-in-time payments. World trade financing today requires banks to accept bills of exchange in trade, and importers maintain tens of trillions of dollars in bank balances as collateral for their overseas orders. The chart shows that the size of cross-border bank deposits, as reported by the Bank of International Settlements, track the volume of world exports during the past 40 years, rising rapidly during the early 2000s as trade growth accelerated and leveling off after the 2008 financial crisis as trade stagnated. The Bank for International Settlements breaks down the volume of cross-border deposits by currency, and the dollar dominates, with more than $16 trillion outstanding. These deposits, mostly the collateral for international transactions in goods, services, and securities, amount to $16 trillion low-interest or interest-free loan to the United States. In addition, foreigners own about $8 trillion of U.S. Treasury securities, most of which are held by foreign central banks as currency reserves. Together with the transactions balances in the banking system, total overseas dollar holdings amount to more than $22 trillion, or more than a full year of America's GDP. America's dependence on foreign credit, made possible by the dollar's reserve role, has risen sharply relative to the size of its economy, from about 20% of GDP in 1978 to 110% of GDP today. The world continues to use the dollar because the alternatives are limited. The euro recently has overtaken the dollar as a favorite currency in international payments, according to data published by SWIFT. That's probably a response to the Trump administration's talk about excluding China from dollar payments, as well as other U.S. sanctions against European banks who ran afoul of American strictures. China's currency, as noted, comprises just about 2% of SWIFT transactions. The RMB isn't ready to be a reserve currency, and the Chinese do not yet want it to be. RMB deposits in China remain subject to exchange controls, and there is only limited convertibility between the mainland and world financial markets. The world holds U.S. dollars because they can be transferred anywhere, used to buy any financial instrument, and exchanged into any other currency. The Federal Reserve, moreover, has shown that it is ready to step in to support the financial system in times of distress, for example, after the Lehman Brothers bankruptcy in September 2008 or the COVID-19 crash in late February of 2020. China would require years of cautious steps towards freer capital markets and a gradual end to exchange controls to make RMB a viable reserve instrument. The digital yuan, with all the potential advantages of blockchain technology, remains as experiment limited to a small number of Chinese consumers. For that matter, China does not require the advantages that a reserve currency brings with it, namely a great deal of cheap credit from the rest of the world. Depended on rapid credit expansion to dodge the Great Recession of 2008 to 2009 and is now attempting to reduce leverage in its financial system. A reserve currency implies the availability of more leverage. A reserve currency, moreover, typically is provided by a country that runs a current account deficit. For the rest of the world to have access to a country's currency, that country must provide it, and that means a negative current account. China's current account surplus has shrunk markedly relative to GDP, and its emphasis on raising consumption implies even further shrinkage in the current account surplus, but that is a slow process. A digital yuan, though, well might rewrite the rules of international banking. Because payments can be directly and reliably associated with the movements of goods, the total volume of transactions balances collateral against bank credit issued to purchase goods is likely to drop drastically. In other words, digital currencies may be far more efficient than ordinary currencies. A possible outcome of the research now underway at the new SWIFT joint venture with the People's Bank of China might be the overthrow of the reserve currency system that has prevailed for more than two centuries since sterling became the world's favored reserve instrument and the Bank of England acted as the world's de facto central bank. The United States will wake up 5 or 10 years from now and discover just how dependent it has been on the rest of the world and how much it will cost to cure itself of this dependency. The sterling crisis and austerity budgets that bedeviled Great Britain during the 1970s are a good reference point for what the United States is likely to go through.